We're in our second week of this series called The Name Above All Names, looking at some of the ways that the writer of Hebrews talks about Jesus and characterizes him with some really important titles and descriptions and metaphors that I think paint a really important picture for us of who Jesus is as the one whose name is above all names, who stands above and beyond all the rest. And what it then therefore means to yield our lives to this one whose name is above all names, and how we are to follow after, and how we should see and recognize the hand of this God who is present in our midst. I think that Hebrews does a really helpful job of painting a really important picture for us of discerning and knowing who Jesus is for us. And we'll be reading the second chapter today, beginning in verse 10. The words will be on the screen. It says this: "It was fitting that God, for whom and through whom all things existed, in bringing many children to glory, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For the one who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one Father. For this reason, Jesus is not ashamed to call them brothers and sisters, saying, 'I will proclaim your name to my brothers and sisters. In the midst of your congregation, I will praise you.' And again, 'I will put my trust in him.' And again, 'Here am I and the children whom God has given me.' Since, therefore, the children share flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared the same things, so that through death he might destroy the one who has the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by the fear of death. For it is clear that he did not come to help angels, but the descendants of Abraham. Therefore he had to become like his brothers and sisters in every respect, so that he might be merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God, to make a sacrifice of atonement for the sins of the people. Because he himself was tested by what he suffered, he is also able to help those who are being tested." This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God today. Well, the following is a list of real excuses that have actually been used by real people with their actual employers as legitimate reasons that they had to miss work. Are you ready? First one: an employee couldn't come in to work that day because his llama was sick and he needed to stay home and take care of that. I mean, that happens to all of us, right? What do you do with a sick llama? They gotta have to be cared for. Another employee called in sick because he ate a can of cat food, thinking it was tuna, and then became deathly ill. Now, here's my thing with that one. Like, I get, like, mistaken cans. I don't know why you keep the cat food and the tuna in the same cabinet, but to each his own. But like, okay, you opened the wrong can, and maybe you took a bite, but shouldn't that be a clue? The next one: an employee called in claiming they couldn't come to work that day because their grandmother poisoned them with ham. See, with this one, I'm thinking that call should have been to the police, because if you seriously think my grandmother's trying to poison me with food, first of all, don't eat her food. But then you got bigger problems than not being able to come to work that day. Oh, another one: they couldn't come in because a fortune teller told them that if they had stepped foot out of their house, they would suffer a brain hemorrhage. I don't even know where to begin with that one, so we'll leave that alone. This one's great. Someone called into work. Again, these are real people who really call into their real bosses and really say this stuff. Like, this is legitimate to them. They couldn't come in because they accidentally got on a plane. How is that possible? Like, I really wrap my mind. Like, in what scenario would it ever be legitimately possible that you accidentally get on a plane? Like, there's so many safety measures and, like, things going on. They're not going to let you through security. You've got to stand in that line like everybody else with your ticket number and wait until it's your turn. Like, you don't accidentally get on a plane. It's crazy. Let's see here. This is great. One person couldn't come in because they had to attend their wife's cousin's pet's funeral because they were the uncle and were also the pallbearer. That's fun. Yeah. Oh, this one's great, too. Someone claimed they couldn't come in because someone had glued all of the doors and the windows shut on their house, and so they were trapped inside the house. This one's great, too. Someone couldn't make it into work that day because their false teeth flew out the window while they were driving down the highway. Like, what were they doing with their false teeth before they flew out the window? Did the fixodent not work? I don't know. I don't understand. Maybe when I have false teeth, I'll understand. But, this one is great. Someone couldn't come into work because they were suffering traumatic stress from finding a large spider in their home. It is traumatic, I will say. I mean, the next one, this is one of my favorites. Someone wasn't able to come into work that day because they caught their uniform on fire by putting it in the microwave to dry. Like, I think you just question everything at that point, right? Because, like, what's worse, that their uniform caught on fire or that they legitimately thought, I should put this in the microwave, that'll dry it quicker? Why not the oven? Matt, good call. This person couldn't come into work because they caught a cold from a puppy. Puppies are ruining our lives. Someone else couldn't come in because he locked himself inside his house by mistake, and the house didn't have any windows to crawl out of. How do you lock yourself inside a house? I don't know. One person couldn't come in because they thought the office would be closed for Flag Day. I mean, we all know Flag Day is a big deal. You got lots going on, so why would you go to work? Another person, the wind blew the deck off their house, which, like, this one, again, like, if the wind is so bad it's blowing the deck off your house, wouldn't the wind be bad at the place that you work? Like, wouldn't they say, oh, it's a windy day? I don't understand how you'd use that as an excuse. Oh, this one's another great one. A male employee claimed that he had morning sickness. If you're going to come up with an excuse not to go to work, I'm pretty sure you should have it, like, biologically accurate, capable. And then last but not least, the dog ate their work schedule. Again, real people said this stuff. And I'm thinking, you know, it didn't work in third grade and you try it as an adult? Wow. Just, it's striking, isn't the lengths that people will go to avoid doing something that they would rather not do? I mean, it's kind of amazing. All of this, I mean, how much time, energy, and effort is spent trying to concoct and come up with these outlandish kinds of excuses to somehow sell it to their employer that they're not coming to work just so that they don't have to go to work? I mean, work really isn't that bad, is it? Now, I get it. Like, all of us have those days where we wake up and the last thing we really want to do is we want to go into work that day. I think anyone who's worked for a number of years, probably those of you who are retired, you remember, man, there were some dog days. I didn't want to do it, and I did it anyway. And we all have those kinds of days. Work is not necessarily meant to be fun. But, I mean, work does also provide us an outlet to be productive with our lives, to do something that's useful. And I mean, there is this kind of really neat thing about work that they compensate you for the work that you do, or at least should be, so that you can help to provide for yourself and your families. And so it's not like work is all bad, and it's certainly not as bad as some people would make it out to be. But, I mean, it strikes me that if there are people who are willing to go this far just to avoid something as mildly discomforting as going to work, Can you even begin to imagine how far most people would go, and I think probably us included, to avoid something that truly causes genuine suffering? Right? I mean, nobody wants to be on the suffering list. No one is looking for an outlet through which they can seek suffering. If we can, and I think our general approach, more often than not, for most every single person who is alive and who understands the ramifications of what going through genuine suffering is, I think our general approach tends to be that we want to minimize suffering as much as we possibly can. And if at all possible, we would love just to avoid it altogether, right? Like, let's just sleep through that suffering and just go to the other side. I don't want to actually have to live through and endure suffering. And you know why, don't you? Because for most of us, there isn't really some good purpose that suffering serves, right? I mean, it's not like somehow that if you go through a certain amount of suffering that somehow it's gonna really like bless and benefit your life. Like somehow if you suffer that really it's gonna turn out to be for your good and there's gonna be these good outcomes for you. It's not like that suffering somehow can actually like make your life more beneficial or better. Suffering is a deficit. It is not an asset. And I think that even for those of us who can accept the fact that sure, there are lessons to be learned through suffering, that we suffering in and of itself is bad and it's no good, but certainly like if we're paying attention, that we can learn some certain lessons through that experience so that maybe we don't have to repeat that again, or maybe we might grow and become a better, more well-rounded person. Certainly, there are those of us, and I would hope that those of us in this room would recognize that, yeah, suffering's no good and we don't enjoy it, but yeah, we can grow because of it. Even for those of us that recognize that, still, that doesn't make suffering good, because wouldn't you still say that even if you say, yes, I've learned lessons through suffering in my life, wouldn't you still say, but man, I wish I could have learned those lessons pretty much any other way possible, right? I mean, if there is anything good that we can discern or understand about suffering in the world, in our lives, if there's anything to draw from it that has any quality of good, I think it's simply this. We've survived so far. But see, that to me is what makes what the writer of the Hebrews in chapter 2 says about Jesus so odd to the ear. Because there in verse 10, he says, it was fitting that the Son of Man should suffer. Fitting. Like he deserved it or something. Like it was good for him. Or he goes even farther because he says that the Son of Man, this person of Jesus that God would send into our midst, that he would be perfected in sufferings. Like, what Twilight Zone universe does that make sense in, where the word perfect and the word suffering go together in the same sentence? I mean, we would never be caught dead saying suffering and perfect going together. There's nothing perfect about suffering. And yet the writer of the Hebrews would say that Jesus was actually perfected through what he suffered. Now, if that's a little strange for you to hear, I have to tell you this morning that for the ancient world religions, for the religious world of the day that the writer of the Hebrews would be writing, this was mind-blowing. Because here's the deal. The gods, whoever the deity is, can't suffer. Because here's the deal. If there is suffering to be had, in the ancient mindset, it was because of some deficiency or some lack. We suffer because we're incomplete. We suffer because we make mistakes. We suffer because we live in a world that is not perfect and things don't always go right. And because we're finite, right? Because we're limited, we can't do anything to stop the suffering. Therefore, we suffer. But if God is all-powerful, all-knowing, eternal, then he shouldn't have to suffer a thing, should he? Because if your God, whoever that God would be, lacks anything so that he can't stop his own suffering, what kind of God is that? You kind of understand that strange dynamic. Why this would be so strange. See, for other gods, it says that that something is wrong with God if God is suffering. And yet for the writer of the Hebrews, he says not only was it fitting, but God was actually perfected in his sufferings. See, for the writer of the Hebrews, and I love this, suffering was not some lack in God. Suffering was not because God was deficient in any way, but that, see, that we turn the whole thing right on its head and we say God is actually gets God's glory through God's suffering. God is, in fact, the God who is above all other gods, the name above every other name, specifically because he is the God who would suffer. See, it's not a lack for Christians. It is that God is super abounding. It is that God is bigger and greater and more powerful and stronger than any other God that ever could exist. That God would love us so much to pour himself out for us, to us, says our God is actually greater, not less than. And this has been this whole kind of case that the writer of the Hebrews has been building since the beginning of chapter 1. We didn't get to deal with it much last week, but the last phrase of verse 4 in chapter 1 says that he had a name that was even above the angels. And in the rest of chapter 1, he lays out this case, quoting from Scripture, of why Jesus is greater and better than even the angels. And really his point in chapter 1 is the angels are subservient. They are messengers for moments and times, while the Son is the eternal one. But here in the beginning of chapter 2 and in the verses just preceding our passage today, he says, and while this Jesus who was above the angels, greater than the angels, he would also become and be made for a little while even less than the angels. But there in verse 9, he says, but this was where he would then therefore be glorified. Because what God does for us in giving God's self up for us, it's for us really greater than what any other God, I don't care how powerful you believe him to be, could ever do. Could ever be for us. See, the beauty of the Christian understanding of God is that God's glory is not in God's autonomy or in God's separateness from us, but really it's in God's abasement. It's in God's stepping down into our midst. The way that we recognize the glory and the honor and the majesty of this God is simply because he would be this God to love us as much as he does. And therefore, for the writer of the Hebrews, he says, and it's this much, that he would share in all things with us. He literally says that he would become like us in every single respect. And so that means that everything down to the smallest detail of your life that makes up your human condition, that makes up the circumstances and the situations that shape and form your life, the triumphs and the difficulties, the good, the bad, the ugly, the in-betweens, the day in, day out, nitty-gritty stuff of just what it is to be alive and to live in this broken and fallen world. It says that Jesus would love us so much, he would consider it his glory. It would be fitting for him, because he loves us so much, to step out from the places of heaven, from seated at the right hand of God, to step down right into the midst of the dirtiness and brokenness of your life and my life and the world around us, because he loves us that much. It really reminds me of Mother Teresa in a lot of ways. And those of you that were here last week probably remember we shared a few details from Mother Teresa's life. She was an extraordinary person and an example for all of us to recognize what true love, Christ-like love, self-giving love truly is. But one of the things that I love about Mother Teresa is that when she was there in India and that she was working as a missionary, teaching English, doing important and helpful work, loving people, caring for people, that she had no business doing so. She wasn't an Indian by nature. She wasn't born in India. She had a nationality from somewhere far from that place. And in fact, once she became a nun and left, she never saw her family again. She had already sacrificed so much. She'd given so much to do this work. But when she received that call within a call that we talked about last week, that call to not live in the convents and do the work of teaching that she was doing, but instead to go and minister to the poorest of the poor in the poorest of the poor of places in all the world, she took that call. But see, the thing is it wasn't enough for Mother Teresa to recognize the needs of others and to show compassion. Like that wasn't enough for Mother Teresa. It wasn't enough for Mother Teresa to raise awareness and do what most people do. Let's create a foundation or let's create a charity organization that's going to raise funds and help these poor people over there. It wasn't enough for Mother Teresa to live in the confines of her covenant or her convent and to have 3 square meals a day and to be provided for and taken care of and to receive her salary when these people around her were impoverished and were broken and were the poorest of the poor. For her to just, you know, well, let me give a little bit off the top. But instead, for her, the only right, fitting, and justified response to the call that God placed upon her because of what God has done for us in Jesus was that she would give up everything to become just as poor as they. See, she chose to be their neighbor. She chose to move into their neighborhood, to become one of that community. One of the things I love the most is she decided, I need to take on an Indian nationality so that I can become one of my people. And when my people are begging for food because they have nothing, there you would find Mother Teresa begging for food because she had nothing. In every way, in every respect, she became like the people. She felt God called her to go and serve. I love this quote from her. She says, there are two kinds of poverty. We have the poverty of material. For example, in some places like India, Ethiopia, and other places where the people are hungry for a loaf of bread. Real hunger, she says. But also there is a much deeper, much greater hunger. And that is the hunger for love. And that terrible loneliness. And being unwanted and unloved. Being abandoned by everyone. You see, it was not enough for her to treat the former and ignore the latter. To love for her really is emblematic of the love that she received, the love we all receive in the love of Jesus. That to love is to step foot in the same streets, the same places, the same circumstances, to walk the same path, to go the same road, to become in every way possible like us. And see, the writer of the Hebrews, he says that Jesus has done exactly this for us because he would become and made a brother to us. Imagine that for just a moment, that Jesus would become so united with us out of this great depth of love, willing to suffer for us, that he would become like a brother to us. Then he also says that he would be a liberator for us, that he would become so enmeshed in the brokenness of our lives and in the bondage and the chains that we live in that we ourselves can't break out of, that he would step foot right into those same prison cells that we make for ourselves, to break us out of them so that we don't have to live in them any longer. See, to get us out of it, he had to first get himself in it. And then finally, he says that he would be made a high priest for us, to make atonement for our sins, to make way that forgiveness and that atoning sacrifice for sins and that forgiveness that God gives could wash over us and wash away the guilt and the shame of our past and the things that we've done, so that we can live afresh and anew, washed clean, white as snow, letting the red stains of sin, the crimson, be washed away. This is what your God has done for you. This is what your God is willing to sacrifice himself, to suffer through for you. So the writer of the Hebrews would say this: what an advocate we have. What a faithful friend we have, who not only knows what we go through, who not only looks down on whatever your circumstances are today and those places where you feel like I can't and I'm not enough and I don't have enough and I've tried and I've failed so many times, or I don't know what the answers are. Every time you feel that, you have an advocate who has felt those same feelings, who has gone through those same sorts of circumstances, who know what it is to feel limited and not enough, who knows what it is to feel like we don't have all the answers, that we're incapable, who knows what it is to walk the road you're walking, but who doesn't look from the other side and look down upon you and say, pull yourselves up and try harder, or doesn't look from the other side and say, better luck next time, but instead would be the one to do what only he would do, to step right back into it again. Right back into it in the midst of your life and my life. To give the grace and the mercy and the help and the support to advocate for us, to fight for your life and for my life on our behalf for us, to help us in those places where we need it most. Thanks be to God.